Welcome to another UCTV.tv podcast presented by University of California Television.
By way of full disclosure, I'm a life member of the AMA, the NMA, as well as PNHP. For some of you, I'll translate. That's the American Medical Association, the National Medical Association, and the Physicians for a National Health Program. I have been asked over and over again, what is an allergy asthma group doing talking about disparities? And I hope these first few slides will answer the question. But I have to tell you that in the 25 years that we practiced downtown in San Diego, and caring for asthma patients made us aware of the problems of the what I learned to call the three big E's in the inner city care of asthmatic children. And that was the economics, the lack of education, and the inability to educate our parents in the management of complex asthma diseases, and ethnicity, and the failure to understand what the patient or the mother was hearing when we were speaking what we thought was very clear, simple instructions. And that's why we added the word disparity, which you see I've emphasized in this slide, in the delivery of health care in the United States. And we in the Physicians for a National Health Program have been proselytizing for many years to try to get universal health care for every person, man, woman, and child in the United States. Mike Lenore, one of my first fellows, gave the first lecture and focused on this very problem of asthma in urban inner city children. That was in 1999, and people were beginning to be aware of the special problem of that area. I'm not going to go through the rest of the 12, but I've listed them here for anybody who cared to see it. When the video of this program comes out, you can stop and read the whole slide, as you can with this one, which is the introduction to Sandra Daly. Now, I have about 8 or 10 pages of material on Sandra. She's a beloved friend to almost everybody in the med school. I've never known an academic who was so uncontroversial in terms of love and appreciation. So I was asked by Hal not to drag on this introduction and take time from Sandra's talk. Otherwise, the next 12 slides would be what I was studying. What I did was just outline the honors here for you, just a brief overview of the few honors that she's received just recently, of course. The Department of Pediatrics has taken over the management of this series because I am getting long in the tooth. Dr. Gabriel Haddad, who's our chairman, and Dr. Hal Hoffman in the Pediatric Immunology and Allergy Division, arranged this lecture today with a very prominent pediatrician who's in your directory, but who, because of health reasons in the family, was unable to make it. And that is why I am so honored and privileged to have my friend, Dr. Sandra Daly, who will speak to us on unnatural causes. Is inequality making us sick? Thank you.
Good morning. I thank Dr. Hamburger for that wonderful introduction. Dr. Robert Hamburger, who forever has asked me to call him Bob, but it's too painful for me to do that. So Dr. Hamburger, he's one of the most important people in my life. He's my professor and mentor, and part of the reason my career is as it is. He truly embodies many of the values that I have chosen to internalize in my life. And so it's a distinct honor to have him, for the first time, introduce me to you. I don't really quite like the slide he made of honors, but in our culture, that's what's meaningful. In some cultures, however, what's meaningful is my family heritage as part of the introduction. So I would like to give you that very briefly before I start my presentation daily. I am Latina. I was born and raised my childhood in Panama. For those of you who are challenged geographically, that's Central America. Remember the canal. It once was ours. Daly, that's my mother's maiden name. My grandmother, on my mother's side, was a Stewart. Isn't this interesting? From Jamaica, her family came to Panama to build that canal. My grandfather, Daly, is from the island of Montserrat. Montserrat is in the Caribbean, and it is an island that once was 99% Irish in its population. So the Daly is not Scottish, it is Irish. I am, of course, of African heritage. That's what you see. Well, on my father's side, I don't know my father, but that last name was Ford. And the other name was Murillo. Latina, my first language is Spanish. My adopted language is English. And I've lived most of my life in the United States. My family was the typical immigrant family. Education and hard work will see you through. And it has. There are five in my family, siblings. One is a woman's health practitioner in Louisiana. One has a law degree and teaches junior high. And she says she needs the law degree to do that. That's urban inner city Los Angeles. Brother, born and raised in the United States, and consequently has evidence of the health disparities that we're going to talk about. He is 47. He's a teacher, first grade, and at age 46 had his first spontaneous intracranial bleed due to hypertension. My last sibling, a brother, died at age 28 from renal failure. So, also born in the United States, and for the boys, father was of African American descent. So, this presentation is not only a career of career interest, but also of personal interest. So I share both my knowledge as a pediatrician and my personal history as an individual like you in this presentation. I'd like to start this presentation looking at the global perspectives or influences that result in health disparities. I choose not to focus on race and ethnicity as the primary variable when we discuss health disparities, because I found that when I do that, a certain population in the group really personalizes it and choose to isolate, shut down, and really sort of dwell in that space where you are a victim. They miss a lot of the information that is imparted in this presentation. The other population that does not feel victimized tends to feel, well, that's somebody else's problem. Yes, I'm compassionate. Yes, I will try to do my best to ameliorate the problem, but that group does not own the problem, not even at all. One group personalizes it, owns it. The other group maintains an objectivity or distance that interferes at times with their ability to participate in identifying the solutions and consequently or ultimately acting on the solutions. So I begin with the global perspective, a more global perspective, and then I try to drill it down. So I am here to entertain you as well. To that end, I'm using television.
There's one view of us as biological creatures that we are determined by our genes, that what we see in our biology is somehow innately us because of who we were born to be. What that misses is that we grow up and develop. We grow up as children, we grow up as adults and continue. We interact constantly with the world in which we are engaged. That's the way in which our biology actually happens. We carry our history in our bodies. How could we not?
The answer is yes. Now, most of us are healthcare providers, so we're used to taking tests. Today is no different. This is a quiz. Now, most of us are healthcare providers, so we've learned how to take tests. I expect that all of you will know the correct answer because this is multiple choice. Now, what you may not know are the factoids behind the answers. So that's where we will spend most of our time. We read very quickly. I want you to let me read the test question before you answer. When you answer, that will be your final answer. Okay? So don't think, just shout it out. How does American life expectancy compare to other countries? A, number one. B, in the top 10. C, 29th place.
C.
See, I told you. However, at 77.9 years, we are tied with South Korea and Denmark for 29th place to 31st place, despite being the second wealthiest country on the planet, measured by per capita gross GDP. Japan has the highest life expectancy at 82.3 years. How much does the United States spend per person on health care? A, B, or C?
C?
Correct. We spent $6,000 per person in medical care in 2004. Estimates are going up. I didn't change this slide. That's more than double the $2,552 median of the 30 OECD countries, that's Europe, yet our health outcomes are among the worst. Where does the United States rank in the percentage of population that smokes cigarettes? Are we number one, top five, top 10, 11th to 20th place, or below the 25th, lowest smoking rates? Yes?
C.
Below the 25th, E. Japan has the longest life expectancy, however, and the highest percentage of smokers. The French smoke more and live longer than us as well. The Germans drink more. That beer and Riesling can do it. And live longer. But the United States has by far the greatest inequality, the fewest social protections, and the most poverty. And my mentor, Dr. Hamburger, said, economics, education, and ethnicity are the primary drivers in his estimation. And it appears that he will be proven correct. What is the greatest difference in life expectancy observed between counties in the United States? 7 years difference, 15 years, 22 years, or 25 years difference in life expectancy between counties? B, 15 years. I got you going. You think we're worse off than we are. Populations in some wealthy communities live on average well into their 80s, while others in some inner city neighborhoods and our Native American reservations barely scratch 60. Between 1980 and 2000, how did the life expectancy gap between the least deprived and the most deprived counties in the United States change? C. As economic inequality grew after 1980, so did the life expectancy gap between the rich and the rest of us. In contrast, a recent study showed that premature death and infant mortality gaps narrowed between 1966 and 1980, when we were vigorously addressing inequalities. African American males in Harlem have a shorter life expectancy from age 5 than which of the following groups? Japanese, people from Bangladesh, Cubans, Algerians living in Paris, or all of the above? E. You guys are so good at taking multiple choice exams. You don't even have to know the factoids. You can choose the answer. The biggest killers of African American males in many poor, segregated urban neighborhoods are not violence or drugs or HIV/AIDS, but heart disease, stroke, and other chronic diseases that cut down men in middle age. Children living in poverty, this is our territory, are how many times more likely to have poor health compared with children living in high-income households? Yes? C, 5 times. No. 7 times. Children are the most vulnerable, as we know. Not only are they susceptible to substandard housing, poor food, bad schools, unsafe streets, and chronic stress, but the impacts of childhood poverty are persistent. They're cumulative and last into adulthood. On average, how many more supermarkets are there in predominantly white neighborhoods compared to predominantly black and Latino neighborhoods? About the same? 2 times as many? 4 times? Or 6 times as many? C, I heard C. 4 times as many. And I think this is interesting for us because in our Department of Pediatrics here at UC San Diego, we have a division that used to be called the Division of Community Health. We now have an office in what once used to be one of the most impacted areas of San Diego, City Heights, urban inner city neighborhood, with no market, major supermarket at the time, and lots of liquor stores and ma-and-pa markets where everything was expensive, including purchasing fruits and vegetables. The cost of an apple there was a lot greater than the cost of an apple at Albertsons. Our division focused on this issue of community health, moved into City Heights, and our nutrition unit focused on the issue of supermarkets, and subsequently brought in the first farmers market in San Diego in an inner city neighborhood that also accepts food stamps in order to pay help families pay for fresh fruits and vegetables. And that's who we are, UC San Diego, Department of Pediatrics. We are aware most of the time. Generally speaking, which group has the best overall health in the United States? A, B, C, or D?
A.
Is that your final answer? Okay, good. That's true. However, the longer they live here, the worse they fare. On average, which of the following conditions is the strongest predictor of your health? Smoking, I already debunked that. What you eat, whether or not you're wealthy, whether or not you have health insurance, or how often you exercise.
C.
On average, the better your health, if you're wealthy, the better your health. The most important factor behind the 30-year increase in U.S. life expectancy during the 20th century was new drugs, social reforms, development of the modern hospital system, migration from the countryside to the cities, more exercise and less smoking. We know it's not E. B. Yes. Researchers attribute much of our increase in life expectancy to the social changes, better wages, housing, job security, and working conditions, civil rights laws, sanitation, and the protections that enlarged our middle class. Citizens of other industrialized countries have longer life expectancies and better health than we do because E and C. It's C. They are more egalitarian. Today, the top 1% of American families own as much wealth as the bottom. Between 1979 and 2005, the top 5% of American families saw their real incomes increase by 81%. During the same period, the net worth of the bottom 40% of American households decreased by half. What is the annual cost to businesses in the United States for chronic illness? C. The financial burden is astronomical, $1.1 trillion. Ireland, Sweden, France, Spain, Portugal, oh, to live there, and the other Western European nations all mandate by law paid holidays and vacations of 4 to 6 weeks per year. How many days of paid vacation are mandated by law in the United States?
89 million.
That's correct. It's not mandated. We're lucky we work where we do.
Living in America should be a ticket to good health. We have the highest gross national product in the world.
I'm very happy to finally have some of my cars in one location, some of them.
We spend $2 trillion per year on medical care. That's nearly half of all the health dollars spent in the world. But we've seen our statistics. we live shorter, often sicker lives than in any other industrialized country. We rank 30th in life expectancy.
Especially of economically developed countries, we are at the bottom of the list.
A higher percentage of our babies die in their first year of life than in Cuba, Slovenia, Estonia. How can this be? Is this just because 47 million of us have no health insurance?
Healthcare can deal with the diseases and illnesses, but a lack of healthcare is not the cause of illness and disease. It is like saying, since aspirin cures a fever, that the lack of aspirin must be the cause of the fever.
Or is it mostly because of our American diet and personal health behaviors?
Those behaviors themselves, in part, determined by economic status. And so our ability to avoid smoking and eat a healthy diet depends, in turn, on our access to income, education, and what we call the social determinants of health.
But wouldn't our genes trump social determinants of health?
Among twins who live together until age 18, who basically grew up in the same households, so had at least a relatively similar exposure, if they diverged later in life, if one became professional and the other was working class, they ended up with different health status as adults. This is among identical twins.
Written into our bodies is a lifetime of experience, shaped by social conditions and policies that can determine who will be sicker, who will die sooner.
There are ways in which our society is organized that are bad for our health. And there's no doubt that we could reconfigure ourselves in ways that would benefit our health.
There are huge inequalities in the society. All this wealth is maldistributed.
Pet food, ice for the pets, water.
And I think that's in part why the U.S. as a whole has relatively poor health amongst the rich countries, and why even the better off people are suffering. And we think that that is not inevitable.
Unnatural causes. Is inequality making us sick?
In order to sort of bring this part of my presentation to a conclusion, I want to show you this clip about a woman named Mary Turner.
Food that we buy lasts about 2 weeks. We spend like $125, $175 a month for groceries, if not more. You know, I've got like three teenagers, so, and you know, about the end of the month, I start reducing to 1 meal a day so that I can make sure that the kids got everything they need. You just do what you can, you know, to survive. I mean, that's about all it is, the survival. We really don't go too far out of the realm of what's necessary. You know, snacks aren't something that's something we buy a lot of. I mean, I just go along and see what's the less expensive. How much can I feed? How many people can I feed for that amount of money? Those types of things. I spend a lot of time frozen foods. I mean, when you get these, the family size, and they're $1.99, and you can feed four people with it, you know, versus maybe four with $4. I mean, what's your choice is going to be? You know, especially when you're on a $200 a month budget for food. You know, you can't go down there and buy a 5-pound bag of oranges because that might be 2 meals for one bag of oranges. I'm sorry, I'm not going to do that. That's the reason why I think a lot of people that are disadvantaged are unhealthy. And a lot of times you borrow from your bill money, which puts you behind in your utility bills. You worry about, do I buy food or do I have electricity? Okay, if I can only send them this much, are they going to keep my power on or my gas or my water? You know, we never skimp on the rent. The rent's something that, if nothing else, we'll have a roof. You know, of course we're dying young. You know, 60 years old here versus 80 in the eastern section of the county, you know, because those people are more affluent. we don't have a whole lot of choices. You know, you do what you can. And breaking out of it is not easy. No. I read the book, Don't Sweat Small Stuff, and it's wonderful, you know, but you're not living my life. Small stuff, it doesn't exist in my life because my life is like, everything's large. There's illnesses, there's worried about food, there's worried about whether I'm going to have utilities, those are what I stress about. And it's every day, you know, it never goes away. Because you think, well, the kid needs a new coat, okay? What can I borrow from to get this child a new coat? You know, it's always something's going to lose so that something else can be gained. It's tiresome. I wake up every day and I think, okay, I got one more day. What am I going to do with this day? And there's days when I wake up and I'm like, oh God, not another day. You know, there's times when you get so down. You think, Lord, this life's not worth living. You know, just let me go sleep. I don't want to wake up. But you wake up and you keep fighting. And you hope that maybe that day will be a turnaround. It never is, but you hope it is, you know. And as long as you've got hope, as long as you don't give up. And I think that's part of the reason why I still move around like I do. Because I'm not going to let it beat me. It's going to have to get a whole lot worse. I mean, you know, I'm standing here right now. It's like, air is getting a little thin. But I'm not going to let it whoop me.
In 2005, the World Health Organization convened a commission to identify the social determinants of health. Income, social status, education, literacy, employment, working conditions, social environments, including racism, minority status, history, stereotypes, myths, misconceptions, place matters, physical environments, culture, and gender. In 2008, the commission published its report and felt that these were the conditions, the social determinants of health were the conditions under which people are born, and under which they grow, live, work, and age. These circumstances and conditions, as you heard, are influenced by the policy choices that we make. The major recommendations from the World Health Organization's commission are to improve our daily living conditions, to tackle the inequitable distribution of power, money, and resources, and to measure and understand the problem and act. And when we act, to evaluate the impact or the results of our actions. This part of my talk, I like to bring together the notion, one of the other social determinants of health, social environments, and racism. So this is a conversation with Dr. Michael Liu from UCLA.
Biggest myth about racial ethnic disparities in infant mortality is that people think that this has to do with just socioeconomics and that the disparities are really the consequences of racial difference in socioeconomic status. And it isn't that simple.
Infant mortality among white American women with a college degree or higher is about 4 deaths per 1,000 births. But among African American women with the same level of education, infant mortality is about 10 per 1,000 births, almost 3 times higher. In fact, African American mothers with a college degree have worse birth outcomes than white mothers without a high school education.
Think about this. We're talking about African American doctors, lawyers, and business executives, and they still have a higher infant mortality rate than non-Hispanic white women who never went to high school in the first place. So what I've been calling for is a rethinking of an old problem from a new perspective, and to really rethink racial and ethnic disparities in birth outcomes from the life course perspective. And simply put, the life course perspective posits that birth outcomes are the product of not simply the 9 months of pregnancy, but really the consequences of differential exposures across the life course of women of color. We know that racism is stressful, and we know that stress can impact on health in many different ways. It creates this chronic wear and tear on your body's systems to adapt. It wears on the hormonal system, it wears on the immune inflammatory functions, it wears on your metabolic functions, and over time it creates an overload on all of these organs and systems so that they no longer function optimally.
Everyday racism is like gunning the engine of a car without ever letting up. In fact, people who've looked at blood pressures, measuring ambulatory blood pressures for white folks and black folks, young folks, see that the blood pressures might be the same during the day, but at night the white folks' blood pressures would drop and the black folks' blood pressures would stay the same. And so it is. It's like gunning the engine of that car, just wearing it out without rest. And I think that the stresses of everyday racism are doing that.
And then if you were to carry that into the pregnancy, then that gets embedded in both the pregnancy physiology of the mother and the developmental biology of the child. We certainly have done a lot in terms of increasing access and utilization of prenatal care, especially amongst communities of color, and yet we've done very little to reduce prematurity rates. I think that the problem is that with prenatal care, you're trying to cram all these good things into less than 9 months of prenatal care, and then expecting everything to turn out all right in the end, and to expect prenatal care in less than 9 months to reverse all the cumulative disadvantages and iniquities that's been carried forth over a life course of differential exposures is probably expecting too much of prenatal care. So if we're serious about improving birth outcomes and reducing disparities, we got to start taking care of women before pregnancy. And I'm not just talking about that one visit 3 months preconceptionally, talking about when she's a baby inside her mother's womb, and now an infant and a child and an adolescent, and really taking care of women and families across their life course if we really want to do something about improving pregnancy outcomes.
So I think what Dr. Liu, I know what he was talking about, is the allostatic load that we as individuals bear from chronic exposure chronic exposure to the neuroendocrine or neural stress response. This has a physiologic cost. The research is in its infancy, truly, but some of us are trying to measure the allostatic load that individuals experience. It's a composite index that uses all of the above: systolic and diastolic blood pressure, waist-hip ratio, serum HDL and total cholesterol, blood plasma levels, serum dihydroepiandrosterone sulfate, overnight urinary cortisol excretion, and overnight urinary norepinephrine and epinephrine excretion levels. This index is a numerical number that spans from 0 through 10. And 4 or above is identified as a heavy allostatic load. Since this isn't my research, I'm not going to spend a lot of time in discussing how it is done. However, I'm going to show you a graph that talks about the probability of having an allostatic load of 4 or higher, which means a heavy load, as predicted by poverty-income ratio and poverty-income ratio and race. The lower graph, this graph is of Euro-American are white individuals, white population, with a median income that's greater than 185% of the federal poverty level. Their allostatic load as a composite index is lower than the allostatic load of Euro-American white population with a median income that is lower than the federal poverty line of 185% of the federal poverty line. African Americans with an income that's higher than 185% of the federal poverty line still have higher allostatic load than our Caucasian brothers and sisters. And if you are poor and African American, it's slightly higher still. So the social determinants of health, the conditions under which we are born, under which we grow, and under which we live and age, do have an impact on our physiologic responses and ultimately our health. Unequal treatment, with which you're most familiar, another commission report states that racial and ethnic disparities in healthcare do exist. Racial and ethnic disparities in healthcare occur within the broader context of our environment. Many sources, including health systems, we, the providers, and our patients, contribute to racial and ethnic disparities in healthcare. And I think this is important that we all share the responsibility of finding the solutions, that there's not one individual that is more culpable than another, and that as our health system grows and becomes more diverse, as the healthcare providers become more diverse, it becomes more imperative that we pay attention to this, because we all have our biases. We all engage in stereotyping. We all have some prejudices. And in an environment of clinical uncertainty, like in the emergency room, we do fall back on our backgrounds. We do use unconsciously, as well as consciously, our bias to reach some decisions. So we must do something. If the minimum is measuring and understanding the problem, but we must do it. We must pay attention to these social determinants. That's it.
A very interesting presentation. Thank you. I'm curious, what's your level of optimism with Obama as president and the current healthcare debate that we're ever going to solve this problem, even partially?
Okay. I like the fact that you say partially, because I'm not sure that there's one solution. I think that Mary Turner said it best, hope. We have to have hope. I think that Obama as president gives us, at least from the world's perspective, a measure of hope. I think that the world community was heartened by the fact that we had the wherewithal to elect an Obama, a Mr. Obama, as president. I do not think that he's the panacea. I do not think that he is the Messiah. I do think, however, that it's a refreshing moment in history. When I was in China, I was there right after the Tiananmen Square. And we, as Americans, were really, really impressed with what occurred at Tiananmen Square. And we tried to engage most of the people we met in China in a conversation about Tiananmen Square. And one elderly man looked at us because, you know, there are values and behaviors in China that do not embrace the discussion of sitting around chatting about Tiananmen Square. This is something we do. That's something they do. So he was trying to be nice to us. He didn't want to tell us to be quiet, but that's what he wanted to say. And he said, you know, I don't want to talk about Tiananmen Square. It was merely an incident. And when you live in a country with a history that's thousands and thousands of years old and it's related orally, this was an incident. I think that Mr. Obama is an incident, unless we're very careful. So in response to your question, I have hope. Whether or not we will pass a meaningful health care reform bill, notice I qualified it. I think we're going to pass some form of health care reform. Whether it's meaningful and translatable is another thing, and that's going to depend on all of us.
From your perspective, why is it that the highly educated, highly successful, and wealthy black individual in America is so stressed?
Okay. I will personalize that question because I'm not sure that I know that I do not have all the literature that I can quote to you, so I will personalize it. I am an immigrant, as you know. My childhood was in Panama. And so while I grew up, the diversity of color, race, was present and celebrated. But we were, in my group, all poor. So we didn't have time for race. The issue was economics. When I came to this country with the values inculcated by my parent, the work ethic and the need to get an education and succeed, I was placed in a Catholic schools, Latin, you know. There's your stereotype. And did well. I mean, I met you. I studied in La Jolla, and when I stayed in my very isolated, highly educated environment, I was safe, I was protected, I could study well, I met people, and I established relationships that have lasted for 30, 40 years with people of different races, different ethnicities, different gender, different sexual orientation, etc. I have a comfortable environment. When I go shopping or I go to a restaurant, and I will use the village of La Jolla as an example, since I have had an opportunity to do that often, things change. And the revving up of the blood pressure that was alluded to in the video really becomes real. Really becomes real. Becomes real. About 3 years ago, I went shopping with my family in La Jolla around Christmas. My family is very eclectic. In its mix. racial mix. My husband is Italian from Brooklyn. That's a different race. I have cousins-in-law from Ireland and from China and from Israel. Jewish background, Israeli Jewish background as well. So we are very, very, very mixed up. The women, we went shopping in La Jolla. I was the only person of African background. I was also the person with the highest income. I'm a doctor. Another stereotype. In any case, everyone else was fair. I was the only dark-skinned person. We walked into this shop where there were lots and lots of Shotskis. I mean, this place was loaded with stuff. And my cousins-in-law, they went nuts. You know, they were racing around the place, touching everything, touching, looking. And I was very contemplative because I wasn't into this particular shop. So I would walk slowly and take a look, and I would touch things, and then I would look, move on. And I noticed this young woman, blonde, fair, she kept following me around the shop. And, you know, like, I don't want to look paranoid, but I was getting paranoid. And I kept looking at her, or I'd touch something, and I'd look up, and she'd be right there looking at me. And then I would walk someplace else, and she'd be right there. So I said, you know, Lord, I'm going to just leave this shop. So I started to walk out of the shop, and then I said, Sandra, you're a doctor. You have money. That means power. So confront this lady. And my heart is beating faster, and I'm sort of sweating. And so I'm almost to the door, and she's still on my case. So I turn around, and I said, you know, it is not nice to keep following people around. And she stepped back and got a little pink. And then I thought to myself, oh, man, she probably was just shopping, too, and looking at the stuff you like. You know, maybe there wasn't anything bad about this. So I was sort of embarrassed, but I walked out of the shop anyway. My cousins-in-law were taking too much time, so I walked back in the shop, and I was right. She was behind the counter then. So it wasn't just me. On the same trip, I walked into another shop. It was the jewelry store, and this with my company. And they took care and asked every one of my cousins-in-law, if they needed help. They never asked me. So I had told them I was interested in buying a ring, and so one of my cousins-in-law, the one from Ireland, she said, Sandra, they didn't say anything to you. Do you want me to say something? I said, you know, like, whoa. And by now my neck is stiff, my heart is still pounding. Did I go to bed that night with a high blood pressure? Did my blood pressure go down that night? No. And so she said something. They showed me a ring sort of lackadaisically, and, you know, that was that. So we walked into another shop, and this lady was just all embracing, all inclusive. She really thought that we were the cat's meow. She took me and she showed me this. I bought a $45 pair of earrings. You know, and then I walked out of there and I said, $45 for earrings, and they're tiny. But, you know, that was my overt response to trying to take care of myself in that moment. So that, I think, is why, you know, and it's layered on. It's layered on.
Now, part of your response then needs to be educating black people to raise other people's blood pressures.
Whether or not they're guilty, right? Well, you know, I was sort of taken aback. I thought, you know, you have no proof. And there was the proof, however, it was there.
She was watching you for shoplifting.
Yeah, yeah, yeah. But you know, we all have these intrinsic biases, because after I walked out of there and walked around a bit before we had lunch, I saw another African American young woman who had the natural hairdo. Hers was bigger than mine. She was not quite as nicely dressed as I was. And I looked at her, and you know what I said to myself? And I'm not proud of this, but I will share it with you. I said, ah, it's people like her that probably lets them feel like they have to watch me. Okay? So we all do it. We all have the stereotyping. We all have the intrinsic bias. None of us are protected. I am not protected because I'm female. I am not protected because I'm Latina. I am not protected because I'm black. Any other questions?
Very quickly, Dr. Hamburger alluded in his opening comments to the frustration of dealing with the issue of health literacy in primary care settings. And I wondered, that seems like a problem that's approachable and maybe at low cost, maybe. What degree does health literacy affect health inequality? Is that a large impact or a small impact?
I think that the impact is large. The National Institute of Health and the Federal Healthcare Quality Unit are attempting to do some substantive research in that area and are calls for proposals for us to do research in that area to try to determine the extent at which it plays a role. In the deaf community, there has been work that demonstrates that there's significant impact. Health literacy has a significant impact on compliance, which is dependent on trust, understanding, and negotiating. How you're going to deal with the healthcare issue. And all of those three things are dependent on literacy, on health literacy. So I think it's substantive. The social determinants of health are not really scaled. That list says we have to attend to all of those things. Yeah, they're not ranked. Thank you.
I'd like to thank Dr. Daly for a wonderful talk.
You've been listening to a podcast by University of California Television. For more information about this program or UCTV, visit us online at uctv.tv.